We'd like to thank our patrons for supporting this episode of Registry Matters.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 167 of Registry Matters. Happy Saturday, Larry. Good evening. How are you?
Oh, very well. Thank you. Glad to be with you.
Yeah, I've decided that we probably should invite you back because you're the only person that knows anything about this. Well, I shouldn't say the only person. You're the most knowledgeable person that I know of.
Well, I pitied you if that's the best you can do.
I wanted to throw something at you, some kind of big news in the week of a particular very wealthy golf player. I was riding my bike back from dinner, and this sort of was crossing my mind about the safety of such things and me riding a bicycle, whatever. And so this particular golf star, superstar, had a little bit of a mishap. And I was just like, if you had that much net worth, he's got a net worth of like nearly $1 billion. It's like $800 million. If it were me, I would not drive. I like driving, but I would not drive. I would have, because my body is really, like, he makes his money from driving. Not driving. He makes his money physically using his body. And I wouldn't put myself in a precarious situation where my mishap would cause me to not be able to earn money anymore. And I wanted to get your opinion on this. Since we covered stocks, now we can cover golf real quick, and then we could go talk on the registry stuff.
Well, I would say that there's a lot of logic in what you're saying, particularly when I think this is like his third accident.
Yes. He's demonstrated an inability to function properly.
He's either been extremely unlucky, and I think there might have been the suspicion of alcohol being involved in one of them. I really don't follow very carefully, so I may be spewing, or I don't know what I'm talking about, but I vaguely remember him having one or two other accidents, and there was a suspicion of alcohol involved in one. Am I right, or have I got that?
Honestly, I don't even know. Someone, some golf pro person, feel free to let us know where we're wrong here, but I was really just going after it from this one thing. And so he broke his tibia in this event.
He broke his what?
His tibia. Are you familiar? This is a bone in the lower portion of your leg, in your calf area. It's a larger bone in your leg. It's called a tibia. You've never heard of this word?
Can't say it's ringing any bells.
All right. Well, I guess we should move on from anatomy and sports and move on to registry issues.
That sounds good.
Shall we dive in? Tell us what's going on for the night.
Well, we have a plethora of questions. Do you think we can actually get to them all? They're from the inside and from the outside. We've got a mix of questions.
I believe that we can get to all of them. I will turn on my speed reader voice.
And then we have one article. We're going to talk about civil commitment because that is such a tragic situation. And people constantly remind us that we don't talk about that enough. And then we wanted to bid a farewell to the esteemed, distinguished, I should say, a distinguished talk show host that we forgot to mention last week. I think it was on the agenda, but somehow got missed. So
I think we were packed for time, possibly.
Yes, but the conservative icon Rush passed away, and there's been a lot of eulogies. And although I was not a great admirer, I did listen to Rush with some regularity because I felt like that I needed to be balanced and informed, and I needed to hear perspectives that I might not agree with. So I was a regular listener to Rush.
Completely. And does that round it out and ready to move on?
Let's do it.
Cool. All right. The first question of the night comes from, it says, Dear Registry Matters Guys. And this is the second question. We're not going to cover the first one. It says, in Michigan, the new law removes many restrictions on where you can be present. What restrictions does it leave in place? Can I go to state or local parks now? How about the Detroit Zoo? All right, that's pretty concise and all that.
Yeah, this is from one of our subscribers, and I wasn't able to get him full answer on this because it doesn't seem like anyone knows for certain yet. As best I can understand, if your conviction predates, it's in advance of when there was 2006 and 2011 amendments that rendered the Michigan registry to be punitive, and those were included proximity restrictions. As best the Michigan person that I communicate with can understand it, those restrictions are no longer there for the people who have those older convictions. But I would say the safe thing to do would be, if you're going to live in Michigan, would be to check with a legal professional, or at least with some website like the ACLU of Michigan, where they try to explain what your rights are and how this has changed your life. It would be best to double check that. In terms of the Detroit Zoo, that's just too particularized. I don't know that there was ever exclusion from the zoo, but I don't know that there's not. But it looks like that the people with older convictions may have escaped all those restrictions. But don't hold us to it at Registry Matters.
And they close out and they say, thanks, guys. Great podcast. FYP and et cetera. And then moving on to an article or a question coming over on the Narsal side. It says, dear Narsal, when looking for a place to live, whether it be an apartment or a house to rent, are you required to inform the officer and or landlord of your requirement to register? Can they evict you if you do not tell them and they find out that you are on the registry? Are apartments or homeowners associations allowed to deny your application because of your requirements to register? Thank you for your time. Oh, can I provide some teeny little bit of anecdotal evidence on this one?
Sure.
All right. When I was moving into my apartment, I had no intentions on telling my landlord, and I looked up online and I saw that there's a park that turns out to be 800 feet away, but it's not an official park. So it turns out that they allowed me to live here. And I ended up telling him, I was like, hey, look, this is the situation and I'm sorry I can't live there. But then they came back and said, I can. And he's like, I don't think I can rent to you without telling the neighbors. And I was like, I don't think you have to tell the neighbors. And I even talked to you about it, and he goes, there's nothing in the statute that says he has to tell the neighbors. And he comes back, he goes, I think I have to tell the neighbors. And so back and forth and back and forth. And then he said, you can move in, because he didn't have to tell the neighbors.
So, well, on this one, I really liked it, and I think I'm going to run it in the digest as well, the newsletter that Narsal publishes. I'm going to take the last one first, the last question. Are apartment or homeowners associations allowed to deny your application because of your requirement to register? I would phrase it slightly different. I would say because of a conviction for a felony. In most sex offenses in almost all of our states, there are very few left that are misdemeanors. And the answer is yes, they can't. And that's what they would say. They would say that it's because that you have a felony conviction. They would not. Most management would not say it's because of it being specifically a sexual offense. So they'll escape you on the last one. So unless you have a particular anti-discrimination clause that includes felons in that particular jurisdiction, that's not going to help you. So we've got that one off the table. Can they evict you if you do not tell them and they find out you're on the registry? I would say probably not, unless they specifically ask you on the application and you omitted the information. I'm a person who believes that if you're not asked, you should not volunteer the information. Now, there'll be 100 emails that'll come in and say, full disclosure is the best thing to do. And that's right. That's all right. That's your opinion. But I did property management for 17 years. And if I did not ask it, I was surprised that anyone would tell me anything. If it wasn't on the application, or if I didn't feel the need to ask it in an interview. So if the answer is yes, they could evict you if they had it on the application and you said no, and you had been convicted of offense, and the application would go something to the effect, within the last X number of years, have you been convicted of a felony or any criminal offense or the minor traffic? They'll word it either way. And if you answer that no, then you misrepresented yourself and they could terminate your contract. So that would be all dependent upon whether your application required you to disclose it. But then we get back to what's really the crux of it, in my opinion. He wants to know about informing them, even if you're not required to. And there may be cases where you're not required to by law, but your PO, your supervising entity, may tell you that you have to notify them. For example, in the state of New Mexico, and I think in most states, but particularly in this state, I know for certain that if you're under supervision, the supervising authority will notify your employer of what you're being supervised for, because they have been hammered with negligence lawsuits because someone got a job and they embezzled the place blind, and they had embezzled the previous place blind, and they were on supervision for embezzling the place blind, and they did it again. And so they will do that. So your supervising handlers may require that you do that, Or there may be states and jurisdictions where they prevent and prohibit clustering. So they may have an issue with you clustering. So they may need to know that. And I'm really unclear how that is enforced, because if you don't know a person's on the registry and your landlord, how would you be able to prevent clustering? That one's puzzled.
Of course.
If you don't know, how would you know? So what would you do?
And that goes. Can you describe clustering?
Well, if there's only one can live at this address. Only two can live at this address. Because what they do is they build these exclusion zones where that a person required to register can't live within all these things. So you end up with a little sliver of land that's in an industrial area, and all of a sudden that's the only place people forced to register can live. And all of a sudden you have an accumulation, and we can't have that because now they're clustering, and who knows, they might network together and they might overthrow the government or something. So they pass these laws that at any given address that only two can live, that are required to register. So you could run into all sorts of issues. So even though it's a great question, the answer is it's all particular to your situation and what jurisdiction you're yep. in. And you're going to have to deal with it when the time comes. And I think for this person, the time's coming fairly soon. So that's why he's asking the question.
And let me, back to your property management experience. I'm going to assume, because my experience with apartments is that they are a single address with apartment A building this. And so does that count for the clustering of it being the 123 Main Street apartment A? Or are they individual addresses for each unit?
Well, that would be my question. I don't know the answer to that, since we didn't have such ridiculous laws here. But it would, my contention would be that each apartment is a different address. But if you were trying to prevent PFRs from living, that you would say, well, 5721 Osuna Boulevard is all one address, and you'd say, well, no, there's actually 164 units in here.
Correct.
And each
one of
them is a unique address, and so I don't know the answer to that. It would depend on a judicial interpretation, unless the statute that created that defined what an address was. And that's where, if the PFRs were not at the table, you could easily have something uncarefully drafted, very carelessly drafted, that would not make that clear. And you could have an enforcement unit, the sheriff's department, say, well, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to keep my community safe, and we're not going to let them cluster in those Oak Crest apartments in there, because first thing you know, there'll be 30 or 40 of them in there, no telling what they'll do.
Yeah, because you would have, if they were all efficiency apartments, they're only 300 square feet, and you could stack a million of them in a square mile, and then you have just a whole, and that landlord happens to be like, hey man, if they pay rent, I don't really don't care. So then they all cluster, so to speak, in this one tiny little space, and you have the super red zone, a heat zone on a map that looks like there's just a billion of them right there in that one tiny little spot.
Yep.
But they're all living in their own apartments and not hanging out with each other, and they're just taking the bus to go to work and doing their own thing. But it looks like, shouldn't live in that part of town because they're all there. Because it sounds like, from your point of view, you wouldn't necessarily have cared. You're looking for the quality of the person and all the other factors. This might be something on your list of things, but you're not going to say, oh, you're on the registry, you're disqualified, just done. Kick rocks.
Well, I should have a guest who used to invite a guest that used to be a tenant of mine who was internet savvy before I even knew what the internet was. And she came and told me that I had PFRs living in the complex. I had two at the time. Yeah. And I had two at the time. And she came and told me about them. And I was unclear how she knew, because I figured that nobody in the right mind would go down to the central office and asked to see the printed list. And she told me, I looked him up online. I said, you did what? And she said, I looked him up on the internet. So then we had a discussion, because she wanted to know how they got past the screening. She said, I almost didn't get in. And I'm a professional. She was a professional. She does tech support and stuff. And she said, you put me through the third degree. She said, how does all these people get in here? And I said, well, first, it's not all these people. And I said, second of all, their circumstances were evaluated, and we did a risk assessment, and we decided that it was worth giving them a chance. But she was very discombobulated that we had anybody on the registry there, and I had no idea that it would be that easily discernible. That was nearly 20 years ago. And she was like, hey, did you know? And I said, yes, we know. How did you know?
Yeah. All right, well then let's move on to a Dear Legal Corner. I was wondering, if I wanted to change my supervised release to another state, is it easier to change that when still in federal prison or when I get out? Also, what are the steps to do both? And I say that with B-O-F-F. And that's thanks so much, Robert. God bless.
So, being that I have limited experience, I did reach out to a federal practitioner. And as best the practitioner knows, there's really not going to be a great deal of difference when you're trying to change your supervised release, because they're generally going to release you to the jurisdiction where you were convicted. And in the federal system, you may have gotten shipped all across the country, because any facility that's appropriate for your security level that has bunk space may be where you end up. And so the practitioner told me that you can request to be released at another location, but they're going to apply the same type of scrutiny, wanting to know if you have connections that would warrant them letting you be released there. And if you don't have those connections and support structure, I think we had a question last week where that came up about being denied because of inadequate support. Yeah. And
correct.
So the lawyer told me that in terms of whether you apply on the outside or inside, he is not aware of them, of there being any difference in terms of the standards. They're going to be looking before they let you move and transfer your supervised release, what type of living environment you're going to have and what type of support structure you're going to have. So as best I can answer the question with the resources I have, it's not going to make a big deal difference. Now, I happen to be just a tad bit more skeptical about people who work in prisons, and I don't think they're looking to do any more work than they have to do. So something tells me, even though I can't, this is only an opinion, I would bet that the person in the prison is going to want to do a little bit less work, and you deal with trying to get your supervised release moved when you get out of prison. The people that are listening to the podcast that have tried to do that from within the federal system before they were released, and if these people help them immensely to be transferred, that would be good information for you to share with the podcast, because that way we can enlighten others that they are actually willing and able and diligently do try to help you get released to a jurisdiction that would be to your liking. So my knowledge is limited. So our listening audience, and we have the best audience, as Rush said, in the whole United States. The people who listen to this program, they do know a lot that they can contribute.
I got you. I think somebody is in chat, but they are being very non-talkative. I would try and impromptu get him to come on, because I believe he is an individual that was incarcerated in a state and then was released into another state. And I'm pretty sure he's fed charges. He's up in the middle north there, starts with a W. I don't know if you remember who I'm referring to or not.
Yes, yes, I think I do.
Okay. And but I just wanted to add one little thing that someone in chat has said. There's not a whole lot going on, lots of work, not much play. RM is my social life. How pitiful is that? And I think that's kind of offensive that it's not that pitiful that this is your social life. I think this is amazing.
I agree.
See?
I think we should do this 7 times a week.
I don't know about all that. That would be a lot of work. I couldn't put up with you 7 times a week. That would drive me crazy.
I see.
Brenda says they seem to be more interested in knowing you have a support network, plans for housing and work and all that. I think that probably makes a lot of sense too.
Yeah, that's what the attorney was telling me, that your support, your level of support has more to do with it than whether you're in custody or out of custody when you're wanting to make the move. But I have so limited experience, I don't want a person to rely on everything I say if we can get better advice.
Well, as you just said, that we have the best audience. And now that Rush has passed, I think our audience is actually quantifiably the best audience.
Well, it would be. And I'm guessing that everybody that listens to Rush is now going to immediately switch to Registry Matters.
I think that's pretty, that could work out. All right, then moving over to another article question to the Legal Corner. I am a federal prisoner, and I plan to be released in Florida. My question affects large amounts of people. While in prison, I have asked the same question to 3 case managers. I have reached out to 4 sources outside of prison. No one can answer my question. They can only tell me what they think, a prior procedure, we've always done it that way, or what they've heard. My question is simple. Where in writing does it state a federal prisoner cannot be released to a halfway house in Florida? I always say things like, who said or why? One cannot fight the proverbial beast unless one knows who the origin of the beast is. I was convicted of blah, 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 blah of a minor. That crime is either the only sex crime or one of the few that allows a person to earn time under the First Step Act. I do qualify under the law to earn time off towards a halfway house or home detention. However, in Florida, in order to be released to home detention, you must get an ankle monitor. To get this ankle monitor, you must go to an orientation. This orientation may only last a few hours, but the orientation is only given at the halfway house. As a sex offender, I can't go to a halfway house, thus no home detention, no First Step Act. This is a catch-22, and just another way to keep sex offenders in prison in Florida. If I can find out why sex offenders cannot go to a halfway house, maybe I can fight the issue and open a path for others. Only two states prevent sex offenders from going to halfway houses. In my situation, no one ever asks why, they just accept. Please give us any help you can. Sincerely.
Wow. So,
yes, there's a lot going on there, but I gotta, if a halfway house is, I think, run by an individual or something of a nonprofit, they probably don't want the risk associated with PFRs, if there is one.
Well, in Florida, you have, and see, the reason why nobody can answer it is because there's a multiple number of answers that go into it. And it's kind of like the one-line zingers. He wants just one simple thing. Is there a statute that says sex offenders cannot go? No, there isn't. I have not been able to unearth it. I shouldn't say no, there isn't. This came up about 2 years ago, and I wrote an email to the Bureau of Prisons, and not surprisingly, they didn't answer it. But they didn't answer it because there is no statute. I can't find it. It's not there. But just because there isn't a statute doesn't prevent things from being done. For years and years in Tennessee, the Department of Corrections told everyone who had an obligation to register about the 10-day, 11-day Halloween festival prohibition against doing. Well, it come to find out, is one of the recent court decisions of the batch of good decisions we've had out of Tennessee. It's been unearthed that there was no requirement that could be imposed. There was nothing in statute. This was just administratively being done. And the people in Tennessee who were required to register were just accepting it at face value and saying, okay, yes, sir, I won't go out on Halloween, and I won't go out for the 10 days. I cannot unearth any statute, per se, that says an offender cannot go to a halfway house. Now, I can unearth restrictions. Florida's a hodgepodge of restrictions that vary from 2,500 feet in Miami-Dade County to various levels of restrictions. So the halfway house may fall within one of those local exclusion zones that anyone that's required to register can't be within 1,000 feet because the halfway house is within 1,000 or 1,500 or whatever the exclusion zone is. So that may be one thing that's keeping the halfway house from. There could be an internal BOP policy, which I don't have any way of getting to that, but there may be a directive in the Southeast region that we don't do that, or maybe it's just particularized to the state of Florida because of the heightened sensitivity. But there are a number of things keeping him from being able to go to a halfway house. And it's a combination of that's the way they've always done it. There are local restrictions that are imposed by cities and counties. And the halfway houses themselves, although they are privately owned and funded by governmental contracts, they're usually nonprofits, as you say. The BOP doesn't own any halfway houses, to my knowledge. They contract with providers. They may just simply not want what they perceive as liability. It's kind of like, I think Brenda could tell you, when Maryland 10 years ago at the legislature, when they were trying to, they were looking at considering civil commitment, the specific sexual offender civil commitment, and the mental hospitals made it clear, the administrators, we do not want those kind of people in our asylums. Yeah, we're not equipped for that liability.
Yeah, Brenda was pretty much agreeing with the point she was saying it just before you were speaking to it, that Florida, that probably are a lot of them are off limits due to the living restrictions.
And it makes it very difficult for the writer of this letter. He can't attack it because it's innocuous. He doesn't know what to file and to whom to file it against, because no one can tell him what he's fighting. So he wants to attack the provision. And what I would tell him is that I wish, I mean, it ought to not be that way. But if I were looking to reintegrate my life and get started, Florida would be way down on the list of places I'd want to be because of all this minutia you're going to have to deal with and how horrendous their sexual offender registration requirements are and the fact that you never get off. If I were you, I would try to avoid ever getting on Florida's registry, because if you're lucky enough to be able to go to another state where you can get off the registry and you've ever registered in Florida, as it currently stands now, they will carry your registration information forever. So if you go to Vermont and do your 10 years, or you go to Minnesota and do your 10 years, you go to Georgia and you do an X number of years and you get released from registration, guess what? You'll still have that image and that information on the Florida registry. So I would try to avoid that would be my advice. But I understand what he's arguing about here, what his issues are, but I don't know what to do about it.
Yeah, I'm with you. And then this last one. This one, dude, this one has a great image. And now, of course, that I say that, I won't be able to, I'll try to get to the picture. Someone has artistically drawn themselves with their head through the bars. This is a really great looking picture. It'll show up on the YouTube side here in a minute. Dear friend, I will be released from prison on August 2nd, 2021. Well, congratulations on it being about 6 months away. Hence, I'm asking for your advice. What is the best states for a PFR on lifetime supervision to live in, and the contact information of any advocates in these states that might be willing to help me find a job as a paralegal? I've enclosed my employment info. Feel free to pass it on to interested individuals. Thank you, Jeffrey. Wow, I'm really impressed by the artistic ability of doing a self-portrait like that. I'm impressed.
Well, now how do you know that he did it? How do you know it wasn't done for him?
Well, that's true. I don't know that. So I'm going to make that assumption.
Well, you know, some kind of nut put this in here, but it's one of those that's difficult to answer, because the last thing that we or NARSL or any advocacy organization should want to do is to cause the states that are not as horrendous to become more punitive with their registration requirements. And so therefore, NARSL has taken the position that we don't encourage state shopping. Now, having said that, I would agree. I wouldn't want to be in one of the harsher states. I just told you where you don't want to be. For sure, you don't want to be in Florida. And I forget where he wrote from, so I was going to take a look at that, but maybe I can find it real quick here. He has written to us before.
Okay.
But I would not, as a general rule, the southern states are not places you're going to want to live, as a general rule. That's not picking on the South, but the high fees Louisiana charges, Alabama for a community notification, it's just very oppressive in the South, and that's where they have the branding of your identification with sexual offender and the litigation that ensues around that. And they have so many exclusion zones of where you can't live and work, and the job restrictions where you can't have these type of jobs. See, like in New Mexico, we don't have the most lax registration requirements in the whole nation, but you can live anywhere you want to. You can work anywhere you want to that will hire you. There's no prohibition in the registration statute that says they have all these things. You can't work here, and you can't even drive an ice cream truck because you might snatch in a child while you're selling them ice cream. Well, we don't have any of that. You have no occupational debarments here in terms of being registered. The occupation itself may debar you, but the law doesn't prohibit you. So in terms of the contact information, since we're not able to refer him to a particular state, we could refer him to the wiki page, which again has a lot of restrictions for being in prison, and we truly understand that. But maybe perhaps someone could do some research for him. I've generally told him the South is not pretty, and I've generally told him that we don't encourage state shopping. But there are states where you would have better registration obligations. But if you got supervision for life, guess what? The registry is going to be a lesser part of your problems.
Yeah, probation is certainly going to be a bigger hindrance than just the registry. I mean, even like Georgia, so you know, maybe you just have to do your registration one time a year, if your conviction's that old, you may not have living restrictions, but you're going to constantly get harassed by the popo.
Now, what do you mean by harass? The police do not harass people.
Yeah, I know. You know, and to be fair, Larry, I was doom scrolling on Reddit and I went by something and there was a cop standing. There was somebody riding a motorcycle and they were kind of hauling ass. But there was a cop in the road. So you think, oh, man, they tagged me. But the cop was standing there and he goes, hey, just wanted to warn you, because if you're on a motorcycle and there's an oil slick that runs for a mile up the road and you're riding in the center where the oil is, you're going to have a bad day. So here was a cop. Don't want to ever like bash them all the time. You know, I can play my little clip here. That'll do just that.
I got my rights to do anything I want to do. I'm a police officer.
So the cops do a valuable service, and this was one that stepped out to keep someone from wrecking and having a really bad day while they're on their motorcycle. But that's what I mean by the harassing, is constantly knocking on your door, hitting you with taillight out, just being a pain in the ass.
Oh, I just looked up Jeff's letter. I didn't have the full thing in here, but what I can say to you, Jeff, is that since you are in state custody in Tennessee, if you've got supervision for life, you're going to be severely restricted. You're not going to be able to do a lot of state shopping because you have to get permission to go to another state, and that state's going to have to agree to supervise you. So therefore, you can shorten your list to states that where you might have connections and support systems that would allow you to transfer your Tennessee supervision. But so you don't have the 49 states as options. You have wherever you have connections and resources that might would be willing to sponsor you. And then you might be able to facilitate an interstate supervision, compact supervision transfer.
And I guess then we are going to go cover this article briefly that is from the Star Tribune. And this
wasn't there one more question here? There's one called G.
I missed loading it.
I'll read it.
I didn't. Please. I got it.
Okay. Well, I think the reader can read, but I can read this one because it's typed and it's mainly just for info. He says, this might seem a strange question for SOs often writing regarding the legality of a law and the registry, but I have a unique situation. And anytime you say you have a unique situation, that is always going to gain my attention because everybody's situation is unique to them. I have been down several years, and in my time, I've been productively working to become a writer. I have 4 complete novels, and I'm currently working on a 5th. I intend to try and publish them upon my release. This is a point of contention. I was told that you cannot publish while incarcerated in the feds for monetary gain. Is this true? There are many who publish and many prison publishing companies for inmates. Is there any way of putting my work out while incarcerated still? In 8 years, I have no other choice. My question is obviously, I would not use my actual name. That would be a death sentence. And so the point is, can he publish? And I could not find the answer to this, but I know our FYP audience knows.
I have a suggestion. Is it Lifetimes? The publication by Will in Illinois? Brenda, help me with the last name.
Mingus.
That would be a place to publish it, is in the Lifetimes magazine.
So, he wants to make a little money.
Oh, well, that part I don't know about.
Yeah, he says that there's a prohibition against publishing by the feds while you're incarcerated for monetary gain.
Sure.
I did not find that on first Google search, but with our expansive audience, someone knows if there is such a prohibition, and we can come back to this next week. But I wanted to get it out there in the audience for our research staff.
All right. Yeah, the article is up on the screen, too. All right, and so now we can go over to this article that I jumped to early.
Yes.
It says, all right, this is the Star Tribune. Case challenging constitutionality of the Minnesota PFR program can move forward. Federal court to decide if state's treatment system is constitutional. Now, why did you people put this in here? What did you want to do with this?
Well, I wanted to try to give the people in Minnesota civil commitment some hope. I was dejected, probably not as much as the people that are there are when the federal judge who had found it unconstitutional was overturned by the Eighth Circuit. But the attorneys didn't give up, and they've been filing everything they can imagine, and the Eighth Circuit has decided that they wanted to give another opportunity for these challengers to show. And they cited an old case from the U.S. Supreme Court, Bell versus Wolfish. And the case is going to go back to the district judge. And I think the quotes that I put in here were useful. It says, this decision gives the plaintiffs another opportunity to demonstrate that the program is not designed to treat and release people, but is designed to confine them, which is what I've said the whole thing is about, said Daniel Gustafson, the lead attorney for the class of offenders who sued the state. Quote, civil commitment has to be focused on rehabilitation and release, as what I've said about John Hinckley when he was confined. That was the goal. If the goal is just to lock these people up forever, which is what appears from the history of the program, that would be punishment, and it's not a proper purpose. So this is going back to the trial judge. Now, the trial judge has already telegraphed to us that he's not too happy about this when he found it unconstitutional. So although the wheels of justice turn slowly, it sounds like the Eighth Circuit has had a change of heart in terms of this Minnesota Civil Commitment Program. So stay tuned, folks.
And civil commitment is what? Let's give a quick recap of what that is.
Well, let's be particular. We're talking about civil commitment of sexual offenders, and how it differs from regular civil commitment, which all states, to my knowledge, have civil commitment. When you civilly commit a person and take their liberty away in normal circumstances, you're doing it for the briefest period of time possible, with the full goal of readmitting that person to society. So everything that happens while they're in custody is merely to keep the community safe and to keep them safe sometimes from themselves and to get them back into society. John Hinckley shot 5 people in 1981. As a matter of fact, we're coming up on the 40th anniversary of that next month. It was March 30th, 1981. He was released. One of those 5 people was the President of the United States. But the goal of the not guilty by reason of insanity verdict was not to see if we could just substitute prison and call it a treatment. The goal was to administer Hinckley treatment and release him, which ultimately occurred. Apparently, in some of the civil commitment regimens that are particularized for sexual offenders, which there's 20 states to my knowledge, and the federal government has civil commitment, there is a far lower release rate, and the goal doesn't appear to be to release people. It appears to be to feed the bureaucracy that they've created and a full employment program for those people. And they spend gobs of money, but no one ever seems to recover from an illness that's only magically discovered after they serve their time.
Yes, they could initiate, you have a 10-year, 20-year sentence. They could initially start treating you, and maybe you finish your treatment in that period of time. But no, they identify that you need to have further treatment at your final 5 days, and they say that they're going to send you off to some further treatment facility, and it's a place you can never check out. You can check out anytime you want, but you can never leave. That's the Hotel California song, but you're never leaving that place.
Well, the odds are low in Minnesota. The odds are a lot greater in other states that have this particular type of civil commitment. People do get out, they get conditional release, and they get more liberties. But in Minnesota, it's a very slim number of people that have been released. And the Eighth Circuit said that despite the fact that so few people got released, there was theoretically a process that would allow them to be released. Therefore, it wasn't unconstitutional. It's not unconstitutional to civilly commit people. I mean, I've said that over and over again. It's unconstitutional to do it in a way that deprives them of due process and deprives them of any meaningful review and deprives them of ever having liberty again. But if you think they're so ill to begin with, why don't you, rather than prosecuting them criminally, why don't you seek a civil commitment in the beginning? You have a hospital in your state. Why don't you, in Virginia or in Minnesota, why don't you seek their civil commitment? The answer is very obvious. You want to extract every bit of punishment you can, and then you want to continue to punish them by putting them in a warehouse after they've paid their debt to society. That is what's so sad and tragic about this.
Anything before we then move on over to the final section?
No, I think I've covered that, but you've folks up in Minnesota, this is a breath of new life into the case, and we're so happy to see and hear about it.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters?
Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
Very good. And now we're moving over to a discussion about the legislative process from something coming out of New Mexico. This is House Bill number 74. And you people put this in here. This sounded, like I said, New Mexico. Something about House Bill 74. Something about the final vote. And I guess I could tease it up front about the way that the voting went about. And trying to get into more discussions about this to try and give people some kind of framework on how maybe they can approach the legislature. And you, as always, Larry, you have an agenda. And what is the reason that you've put this in here? But I really don't see what purpose it serves. So what is House Bill 74 and why would we care?
Well, we put it in because it's a proposal that would provide felons either would not be disenfranchised to begin with if they happen to receive a probated sentence, or they would be re-enfranchised immediately upon release. This proposal would provide that felons would only lose their right to vote for the period while they were in prison, but upon release, they would be eligible for immediate reinstatement. Unfortunately, the Republicans chose to prevent this from happening, and they did a floor amendment when the bill was on final passage in the House.
Tell me what is a floor amendment? I mean, what is the amendment? What does that do?
Well, as the proposal was originally drafted, it had no carve outs. All felons were treated the same. So you, whether you were PFR, whether you robbed banks or whatever you did, if you're released from New Mexico prison, you would receive a paper saying that you are eligible to vote, and you would take that to your local voter registrar, which in most cases is the county clerk, and you would be able to register to vote. Well, the floor amendment was offered on final passage, which is an effective parliamentary procedure it's used. But this floor amendment provides that the sheriff will only be the person who can provide a PFR, that documentation that they would normally get from the Department of Corrections. And that documentation would certify that they're in compliance with SORNA, the Sex Offender Registration Notification Act. And the person can proudly take this to the county clerk, and they will have a special document from the sheriff saying this person's in compliance with SORNA, and everybody else will just say the person has been released from custody and that they're eligible to vote. Now, something tells me, maybe I'm not the brightest person, but I'm not thinking that people would want to display their document from the sheriff. What do you think?
Certainly. I'm trying to wrap my head around that they would get this extra piece of paper that says they're in compliance with SORNA, and then they would have this extra piece to go to the clerk?
Well, they wouldn't have the regular piece. The Department of Corrections can't give them that document. If they have a sexual offense that's going to trigger registration obligation, the Department of Corrections says, too bad, so sad, you're out, go get this. If you want to vote, go see the sheriff and get registered, and the sheriff will give you this piece of paper. And it says that they're in compliance with SORNA. But otherwise, the Department of Corrections would give it to you and saying that you're eligible to register to vote.
Okay. And so let's dig in deeper on what this amendment does for those and who do not know. So what does this do for those people?
So, you want to get into the nuts and bolts of how a floor amendment works, because just make sure I understand the question. So a floor amendment, a bill has been introduced. It has made it through the committee process. In this case, it was a House bill. So it didn't have to go through the Senate. It had to go through House committees. So it went through the House Consumer and Public Affairs Committee, do pass. It went through the House Judiciary Committee, do pass. then it's reported out to the floor for a vote. So a floor amendment is a parliamentary maneuver, and it's very legitimate. And it can be legitimately used because in the committee process, sometimes you legitimately overlook something that was significant was overlooked. Not often, but it does happen. But it's more often it's used for sinister reasons, for you to impose your will as a minority on what you don't like. So, for example, in this case, it's well known that the Republicans are generally opposed to expanding the voter base to include additional felons. All you have to do is look at the citizen initiative that was approved overwhelmingly in Florida and how successfully Governor DeSantis and all the people in Florida have prevented most felons from voting because they litigated and said that all obligations included fines and court costs and restitution and blah, blah, blah. So in this particular case on House Bill 74, it was the Republican strategy was to force the Democrat Party to appear soft on sexual offenders. So they presented this amendment as a tool simply to assist in achieving that. They said that there's no sinister motivation. We just want to help make sure that the offender is in compliance with SORNA. And they claimed it was about public safety. But their real agenda for doing this was they wanted to make it appear as though the Democrat Party was soft on sex offenders. So they made it impossible for the Democrat Party to vote against this floor amendment because you've got this, you're in floor debate and you've got this amendment and it's simply just to make sure that people that have an registration obligation to just make sure that they comply with that to enhance public safety. And if you're a member of the Democrat Party and you vote no on that, what's going to happen in the next election cycle?
Now you have documentation that they voted in a certain way.
So then they get vilified for it. So that was their agenda.
Okay. And if the floor amendment gets adopted, did the floor amendment get adopted?
The floor amendment did. The Democrat Party was not willing to vote against the floor amendment, so it did get adopted.
All right. And then did the Republicans support the bill?
No, they still didn't support the Republicans.
The Republicans added the amendment ostensibly because then they might support it more.
Yes, we want to make sure that we have compliance with SORNA. But then I put the cheat sheet in because people don't tend to trust me when I tell them these things. So I've got the voter tally in the show notes, colored by party registration and a column that identifies the political affiliation. And despite the fact that the Republican House leader, Rod Montoya, sponsored the amendment, they still all in lockstep voted no. They do not want, apparently, they do not want former felons to vote. Now, I know you're going to say, Larry, why are you being so partisan? I'm not being partisan. I'm merely talking about what happened. If you can't identify what happened, then you can never do anything to rectify what happened. Here's what happened, folks. The Republican Party did everything they could to wreck this felon reenfranchisement. I can't change the history. This is what happened. And the vote's there for you to look at, and you can decide.
And I can't help but even, like, personally, the way that this is coming across, cringe at this does sound like you're being super partisan.
Not at all. Not at all. I'm not being partisan. I'm merely being factual. If the day comes that we can't talk about who votes which way, then we probably should just stop having democratic government. Because I criticize the Democrat Party probably more than anybody that does anything like what we do here. But I don't have blind allegiance to the Democrat Party. I don't have blind allegiance to anybody. I have blind allegiance to good public policy. And this was good public policy. And it will continue to be my belief that allowing people to vote after they've paid their debt to society is a good public policy. And the fact of the matter is, the Republican Party of New Mexico did not agree, and they did not vote for it. I can't change that. You would have to ask them why they're so vehemently and adamantly opposed to having people vote. I can't speak for them.
Well, now it might be a decent time to talk about Rush. Why does that particular bent so vehemently oppose having everyone vote?
Well, they would say that it's because of the integrity of the voter rolls. We need to have integrity of the voter rolls. But in terms of felons voting, they mistakenly believe that they're going to have a lot of new Democrat voters.
Sure.
And that's just simply not the case. And actually, I'm probably advocating against my own interest because probably most of these people are not going to vote for Democrats. But I believe that it helps the person to want to be a law-abiding citizen if they're more able to participate in our system. Yeah, it's another one of those things that the more you seclude and isolate a person, the more you can expect bad things. The more you include and have people participate, I think you're more likely to have a good outcome. I think a person is a better citizen that votes, particularly if they take the time to figure out a little bit about the issues they're voting on rather than just voting blindly allegiance.
Well, tell me this real quick, since we're going to now cover international politics. Australia has compulsory voting. I think that's the right word. And they get like 95% participation. Should we have something along those lines? Should we have 100% voter participation or close to it instead of we get 20s and 30%? And that's for the national elections. For the off year ones, we get dismal outcome.
I don't believe in that. I didn't know that Australia did that, but I don't believe in that. I don't think you should require people to vote. I think people should want to do their civic duty. I think they should want to have good governance, and they should want to be informed about issues. And here we have a whole group of people who want to vote, and for some reason, there's this concerted effort to prevent them from ever voting again, and Florida in particular. I think Florida doesn't want those people to ever rejoin the voter rolls.
And that goes way back to that original amendment was Amendment 4 to the Florida Constitution. That probably goes back to the 1800s would be a guess. I don't know if that probably was pre-Civil War. Early 1800s would be a guess without me doing any quick Google searches. If anybody wants to do that for me in chat, then we can report the year that happened. What happens next for this bill in New Mexico? Do you accept the amended version, or do you have a different strategy?
Well, let's be clear. I don't like the amendment, and I hope we can remove it. However, I would not kill the bill because of the amendment, because I'm not one of those that has to have it all or nothing. I would find it tragic that PFRs would have to go in and get their special document from the sheriff that announces to the county clerk that they are a PFR. But I would prefer them at least having the option of doing that versus not voting at all, and all the other people that would be re-enfranchised. So I would hope that it doesn't come to that. But my strategy is to get the amendment removed in one of the two Senate committees. It'll have to go through two committees in the Senate, and I hope to try to get it removed. Although unlikely, I would like to find a Republican senator who would propose striking the amendment. So what you would do is, when it's in committee, when it's being debated, you'd have a Republican say, "I'm looking at House Floor Amendment Number 1. And I move we strike that amendment." And that's not likely, but that would be my preference. My next strategy would be to seek a member of the Democrat Party to make the motion to strike House Floor Amendment 1. And if I'm successful in finding a senator who will do that, then all the Democrats on the committee will be politically exposed on the issue, because the committee vote is likely to go right down party lines. All Republicans will vote no on striking the amendment, and all Democrats will vote yes, or at least enough to pass it, because of we have a fairly significant Democratic majority. So you could afford to allow a couple on committee to vote no, but you're going to expose all of those people on the committee to strike the amendment to backlash and how this is going to be used against them. So like I said, I expect all the Republicans to vote no. These votes are recorded, and it means that the Democrat Party will look weak on public safety and pro-sex offender. So,
well, that's probably not a good way to get reelected, is it?
Not generally.
I heard you people talking about an identical bill that must pass both houses in a bicameral legislature. If the Democratic Party amends the House bill, doesn't that mean the bill would have to go back over to the House for them to agree with it for concurrence?
Wow, you actually remembered that?
I can see how I would have, but I had a little help in crafting these questions.
So, wow, that's exactly what it means. The same identical bill has to pass both. So what would happen is that if we are able to strike House Floor Amendment 1 from House Bill 74, then you no longer have the same bill. So when you strike the amendment, it passes in the Senate with all Republican opposition, as I anticipate, and then it would no longer be identical. So it would go back over to the other side of the rotunda for concurrence. And so the first question always goes to the sponsor. What do you think about this bill? Admitted by the Senate. In this case, the House sponsor would be delighted that the amendment got removed and would give the thumbs up. And that would mean that the Democratic majority in the House would be able to concur, and they likely would concur if it comes to that. But the only problem is then you've got another recorded vote. You've got a recorded vote where the Democrat Party in the House agreed to a watered down version of what had originally passed, and you've got 40-something members of the Democrat Party who have been soft on sex offenders, and they all become politically exposed again. So you've got the Senate politically exposed now, and you've got the House politically exposed, all over the shenanigan of Rod Montoya.
Okay. God, that's garbage. I had a recent where I listened to the Schoolhouse Rock thing where it goes, I'm just a bill, and this whole thing of the bicameral, like going back and forth, if there's amendments, then they have to agree. You can't have it go without having the both parties agree. That definitely leads to me remembering like how that question would get asked. Like I said, I had help getting there. Oh boy. Do you have, let me ask you this question. It says, what about later down in the bill where they limit the governor's pardon powers? How do you think that's going to go? That comes from a person in chat, from Raiders fan in chat.
Okay, what's the question again?
What do you think about where they limit the governor's pardon powers?
Well, I don't think the governor's going to be too interested in that. So I think it'll likely meet with a veto if it passes.
Oh, really?
Yep. What governor would want their executive powers weakened?
I totally get that part. It just then we end up down the discussion of, well, why did Obama not veto blah blah blah? That I know that they get overturned in the recent defense budget thing with Trump. He vetoed it, and then they turned right around and what's the word? That I know they overruled the veto. Would this then, if he vetoed it, would there wouldn't be any support to try and push back against the veto? Like this is weird. Of which the is your governor on your team or not on your team? Is he a DNR?
Well, she pretends to be a progressive, but it goes beyond that. No governor is going to want their executive powers to be weakened. So, as a general rule, anything that would weaken executive powers, the executive would veto that legislation. She's made it clear on there's an attempt to weaken her public health authority, and she has said, go ahead and send that to me. I will veto that. She would veto anything, and as any other executive would, that would weaken her powers. And she would say that it's not about me per se. It's about the ability to govern the state in an emergency. And on this thing, pardons are something, if I were a governor, I don't think I'd be cherishing. I would like more like the Georgia system has, where they have a board that does it.
Yep.
But since the governor possesses those powers, I can't see this governor or any governor wanting to give those powers up. So I would expect to meet with veto. But your question's a little deeper than that. Overrides are unlikely in this state because of the way our system works. They're only in session for 60 days in an odd number year, and they're only in session for 30 days in an even numbered year. If you look at when most things pass, they mostly pass in the final week. Most legislation passes in the final week. And most of the time, it passes within the final 3 days, which means the governor doesn't even have to act on it till they're out of session. So anything like this is controversial, is weakening the pardon power of the governor. It's not going to pass until the final day or two of the session. They're going to be out of session when she issues the veto, and they're not going to be able to override because they won't be there. And then when they come back in January, everybody's facing this member of the House. When they come back in January to the next regular session, they've got a 30-day session, and they've got their own campaigns to worry about. And they're not going to be worried about overriding the governor unless it was something draconian. So a veto is not likely to be challenged. It's just very rare in the state that there's a veto override because our system's not designed for that to happen.
Okay. And can you, with your work around the different states, New Mexico would be considered a small state with a short legislative session? Is that fair?
Well, the majority of the states have short sessions.
Okay.
They're not full-time.
Is yours consistent
with
most of them? I know that they're not full-time, but like Georgia is similar in time frame, I think?
Yeah, like 40 days. Yeah, it's very, very similar. They run 30, 60, 90 days, 120 days max, except for the full-time states. So it's not that odd.
And part of your process, this is all part of wrecking the train, I believe. And right?
Well, it generally, yes. This is a train I don't want to wreck. This is a train I want to see make it to the finish line. House Bill 74, I'd like to see make the finish line. And I'm going to do everything I can to restore it to its original condition of how it was before it was hijacked. But I just want the listening audience to know that a lot of the people that you voted for did this to you.
Okay. I don't know what else to say about that. I know that we have this conversation very, very, very much on the regular, and I just don't have any personal evidence to support or go against. I just accept that what you're saying is true. I just have nothing.
You have plenty of You have ample evidence that the First Step Act was hijacked by Senator Tom Cotton. You have all the evidence you would ever need that happened. So I got you on that part.
I was talking about specifically. You say that our people are right leaning generally, and I just don't personally have any experience. That's the part I was getting. I got you on the First Step Act. I got you on where the parties vote generally, very broad strokes. That red votes for more law enforcement type things that generally screws us. I totally get that, and I know that on the left, things like statute of limitations, the left is voting that screws us as far as a criminal justice issue in general, because 700 years later, someone can say, hey, I feel bad about something that they did to me, and you can go prosecute someone way long after the event happened. And you have no ability to defend yourself. Totally get that. I just don't have any personal to say that these people are this persuasion.
Well, why don't you put a non-scientific tool up and ask people their political leanings, if they're conservative, moderate, or liberal. And I'll tell you that 75% of our audience will check the conservative or more. That's just the reality of what I've learned in all these years of advocacy. I can't even believe you even question it after all the encounters you've had with all the people that you've met. And this, I'm surprised that you even are surprised. I mean, it's a given.
I live in a very red state, in a very red area of the state. So it's not like I can go run around and ask the people in this area how their leanings are, because I would just, this area is very, very red. So that's not a fair, accurate way to look at it.
Well, I'm not talking about I'm talking about the people you interact with in the work we do here, our audience. You've had them from Wyoming. You've had them from every state, from Louisiana. And can you cite to the most recent liberal that we've had that you've let chime in on the podcast? I mean,
I know of them in chat. I know of the handful that are there in chat. There are a number of them. Yeah, totally. Totally. All right. Well, then let's close things out. So now that we went on our own little bent about politics and whatnot. So send all the hate mail to crackpot@registrymatters.co, which gets redirected to Larry. And then just to close things out, I want to make sure that we highlight, though, specifically that when you send us questions, if you get specific and say, my case was this, and I would like to know what I should do here, that can't be answered. So with that said, we received a question from Will and also a similar question from Chuck. It says, would it be accurate to say that the ruling in Tennessee would be successful to the point that PFRs could go back into court and get only the registry restrictions, obligations, etc., that were in place at the time of conviction or plea? I pled guilty on such and such date. Would this ruling mean that I could file a challenge with this as guiding case law and force the state to dial my registration obligations back that was in place in 2002? And again, like I said, there was another question from somebody else that was sort of vaguely similar, but provided a whole lot of details, and we can't give legal advice. So Larry, what do you think about that question?
Well, the answer is no, Will. You cannot do that. Well, you could, but you would not win at this stage, because the case we talked about recently from Tennessee, it's not final, nor is it precedential yet, because it's only the district court. And the odds are that the state's going to find some way to appeal. But let's just say that I'm wrong and that they do not appeal, and that they say, yep, we got it wrong. and there's a slim chance that they could do that. That doesn't say you go back to the conditions you had in 2002. What these cases are telling us and what the legal landscape is showing is that there is some point when a registry becomes punitive, and there's a point where you can peel off restrictions. So would they have to peel off everything that they've added since 2002 to you? I don't know. That may not be the 2000, let's just say, because we read all the times that Tennessee modified the registration requirements, and it was basically every session. So I don't know which year would have been something that would have triggered that analysis. So they might could peel off some of the things, the more egregious things, like in Michigan, it was primarily the proximity restrictions and primarily the tiering of people without due process, you know, the 2006 and 2011 amendments. So, Will, there might be a whole lot of things that Tennessee added in those changes that they made year in, year out that would not have been enough. So there's no court that says you have to put them back to the registration conditions that they had originally. So far, I'm not aware of any such decision. What they've said is you can't apply certain things because this triggers it where the analysis now shows that this is punitive. So what a legislature in Tennessee would be likely to do would be say, how little can we peel back and still have a constitutional registry? That's exactly what Michigan did. That's exactly what Pennsylvania did. That's probably what Tennessee would do. But it's too early. It's too early yet because this case needs to work its way through the court.
So in other words, were we to be the Lone Rangers, we would have a silver bullet and we could just shoot the thing and the registry would go away? Is that what you just said?
Well, I said the opposite. There's no silver bullet going to make the registry go away.
I just wanted to clarify, just to make sure. Is there anything else? Oh, let's do our little tribute to your favorite now deceased radio show host.
We did that.
Is that why all the flags are flying at half mast? Well, I thought we were going to do that was it. Is that all you wanted to say about Rush?
Yeah, unless you have something else to add. But yeah, we did it.
I got nothing. I do think he's a terrible human being. That's all I got to say.
No, you shouldn't say
Let me ask you this question.
They're going to burn our transmission tower down.
Do you think that he created the modern day like talk show format, or would that go to somebody like a Larry King before him? Because I think that he's kind of like the genesis of that whole kind of radio program.
He certainly had the largest accumulation of radio stations, but no, he was not the first. He was not the first by any means. There were people who had nationally broadcast programs before he came along, but he was able to perfect it to a level that no one has ever seen before, and probably no one will after.
All right. I guess then we could say you can find the show notes. Everyone, like, I get this question a lot. So if you've made it this far, if you want to know how to get into Discord, go to either the website or where you'll find a Discord link in the show notes, and that's over at registrymatters.co. And look for any of the show notes, and you will find a link to get into the Discord if you want to listen to the show live. You can leave voicemail at 747-227-4477. You can send Larry email at crackpot and all that, but email us at registrymatterscast@gmail.com. Support the show on Patreon at patreon.com/registrymatters. Larry, you are the best and the most informed person. I don't have anything else. And if that's it, then I bid you a good night.
Thanks, sir. Good night.
Take care, bud. Bye.
You've been listening to FYP.